This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So as you can see from my affiliation, I'm a philosopher of science. I'm a philosopher of paleoanthropology, more specifically. It's a weird academic beast, I know. And I've been invited today to talk about one absolutely uncontroversial topic that has never sparked controversy, nor among evolutionary biologists or philosophers, which is the species concept, right? So with this ticking bomb in my hand, I will try to say, well, what Lucy has taught us in terms of taxonomic reasoning in paleoanthropology, the kind of challenges that naming Lucy has highlighted that are still there for paleoanthropologists to debate over. So the story of Lucy, among many other things, is also a story of naming. So this was the first baptism that Lucy received, a catalog name, of our locality 288, and this is how the skeleton is now known in the very vast hypodigm of the species Australopithecus afarensis that, as we have learned, now includes more than 500 specimens. It is also a story of nicknaming, right? Lucy, the nickname they'd caught on the very first day of the discovery, Dinknesh. Hilo Mali, as I've learned recently, this is how people from the afar know Lucy's specimen. And there's an interesting practice in paleontology and also in paleoanthropology, of course, of giving nicknames to fossils. And part of the reason why Lucy has become an ambassador of human evolution is tied to the fortune of this nickname. And Lucy is a case in point of an ancestor, a human ancestor, becoming a paleo persona, gaining a new identity to the point of starring in movies. Here's Lucy in the homonymous movie Lucy, where we have another Johansson, not Donald, but Scarlett, with a big difference that, well, the science is very questionable here. But what I want to talk about today is the story behind how Lucy got her Linnaean name, Australopithecus afarensis, that was first formalized in 1978 in this Kirtlandia paper, the house journal of the Cleveland Museum of the Natural History. We can read in the last sentence of the abstract, the binomial Australopithecus afarensis species Nova is assigned to this collection of early hominid remains. We're going to dig a little bit more into that. So I want to suggest that Lucy's species attribution, the scientific reasoning behind that, provides a window into taxonomic reasoning in paleoanthropology, where the hard problems are, right? So before getting there, let us address the thorny issue of how are species identified in evolutionary biology and in paleoanthropology specifically. And it is no wonder that evolutionary biologists and also philosophers have tried to grapple with this issue for decades, to the point of developing a sort of, theoretical allergy or theoretical nausea. So there's basically no paper today that doesn't start with a call for saving the forest and stopping to address this issue. So this is how Jody Hayne, a famous opinion piece, opens the discussion. How many evolutionary biologists sometimes wish that not one more word in speech or text be spent on explaining species, right? But I want to suggest that for all the difficulties that are involved in species recognition, right, these are objective difficulties. Well, taxonomy matters. Taxonomy is deeply intertwined with a set of fundamental investigative goals for paleoanthropology, the study of diversity within a lineage. Comparative analysis, right? The reconstruction of phylogeny. And even if it has become fashionable to talk about classification and taxonomy as a matter of quibbling about semantics, well, it is fundamentally inescapable. And the best thing that we can do is to make it as biologically plausible as possible. What is particularly interesting for a philosopher is that, well, in probably no other discipline, nor even other sister paleontological fields, classification is deeply linked with the epistemic profile of paleoanthropology. What kind of science is paleoanthropology? How robust are its inferences? Are we naming too many species or too few, right? And this is an issue that is extremely felt also by authoritative figures in the field. Here's a series of papers that address this problem. Is paleoanthropology science naming new fossils and control access to them? Ian Tattersall and Jeffrey Schwartz. Hominin taxon diversity, factor of fantasy, Bernard Wood and Eve Boyle. Towards a more realistic interpretation of the human fossil record, a recent paper by Bernard Wood and Richard Smith. Taxonomy comes also in the practice of classification with extreme joy. So this is how Ian Tattersall begins one of his recent papers. I've spent a large chunk of my career agonizing about how species should be recognized in a paleoanthropological record. So this is, we learned that taxonomy, thinking too deeply about species, come also with agony. Well, in evolutionary biology, it is usually held that some progress has been made by means of dividing the conceptual labor. So distinguishing two parts to the species problem, one conceptual problem, how we define species, how we think about species from a conceptual perspective, and the second heart of the species problem, how we come about delimiting species, the secondary or the operational approaches to species concepts. There's growing consensus in evolutionary biology that species are best conceptualized as separately evolving metapopulation lineages. This is something that is currently being discussed also in paleoanthropology. Whereas as regards, the second aspect, we know that there are over 30 species concepts available today on the market, but a problem is that, the vast majority of these are, not all of them, but the vast majority are virtually inapplicable in a fossil record. So the evidential context is fundamental. Here's a case of evidential luxury that we are all thinking about. Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, there's now plenty of evidence of gene flow between these two lineages, right? This is a context where the biological species concept, the species concept that we all learn in school that hinges on the possibility of interbreeding, can be addressed in a non-inferential way. There's evidence. So the question is, were Neanderthals and sapiens, good species in light of this recent paleogenomic evidence? And in this recent publication, the strategy that I tried to adopt was to track the primary species concept by means of testable secondary species concept, arriving to a, counterintuitive conclusion. Even in light of interbreeding, there's still good reasons to consider them as separate species. The development of reproductive barriers requires a lot of time. It's a function of divergence time, right? And it's not simply a matter of, a simple yes or no property. So they are as good as biologically realistic species can be. But a problem of species delimitation for the vast majority of human evolutionary career and for most fossil taxa, has one major evidential window, which is the study of morphological variation. Its interpretation and its delimitation, this is the primary window into species status. So how Lucy got her name, this is what I'm going to try to suggest, is, provides a window into the sources and constraints to taxonomic reasoning for most paleoanthropology issues that are still there. They are not purely empirical, they're also conceptual issues. So let's go back to that Kurtlandia paper and let's take a closer look at that. So in the abstract, it is said that the specimens from two sites, the ones collected from Hadar, retrieved by Don Johansson and his collaborators, and another site, the Toli, that is more than 1,000 miles far from Hadar, that is also, older by 700,000 years, the specimens from these two sites belong to one species, and that species is to be called Australopithecus afarensis. What is particularly interesting is that from page 2 of this paper, other taxonomic hypotheses are acknowledged as having been explored before. We can read here, some of these specimens have been provisionally allocated to Homo species and others to species that are affinis close to Australopithecus africanus. So the question here is that, what made Don change his mind? right? And I want to suggest that this preliminary taxonomic interpretation, well, aligned perfectly with the theoretical framework and heuristics that were available at that time. In particular, we've heard this morning a lot about the historical context, so I'm just going to pinpoint two key aspects. First, time frames provide a fundamental inferential window. The quest for homo traits was particularly relevant for the time frame of 3 million years old. So this is where that was the barrier that needed to be broken, right? And a big part in that debate was played by the interpretation of this finding by Richard Leakey, the 1470 fossil from Kobe Fora on Lake Turkana. When Richard Leakey was interviewed about the interpretation of this fossil, he said, "I call it Homo. For me, there are two kinds of hominids at Lake Turkana. All the robust ones I call Australopithecus, all the gracile ones I call Homo." So a second heuristic here. Here we have a principle of exclusion that was certainly at play in the initial interpretation of the Adar material. So some specimens were initially attributed to Homo. So this suggests something that is extremely important and extremely relevant for paleoanthropological taxonomic reasoning also in paleoanthropology today. Taxonomic interpretation is never made in a vacuum, even if we think that we're playing purely descriptive here. The background information, previous taxonomic assignments, dates fundamentally, scaffold, well, new interpretation. And this changes the analytical focus, what traits are to be emphasized in a particular sample. And this creates, when this works as a bias, right, this creates a sort of lamppost effect where the interpretation of the material is sought under the light that has been cast by previous theories, by previous heuristics. And there's good reasons to look for interpretations there, especially if these have been supported by key authoritative figures in the field. So what then when a closer inspection yields results that don't knit well with the available interpretive framework? Something needs to go. And this was the question that emerged from the systematic study that Donald Johnson started with Tim White in 1977. This is beautifully recounted in Lucy, the beginning of Humankind, which in my view provides a precious document of scientific reasoning in paleoanthropology. The value, the generative value of disagreement among colleagues, right? And it also contains some hilarious passages like this one, where Don was still convinced that the Hadar and Letoli sample were two different species, right? Well, Tim White was convinced from the beginning that, well, they sampled one single species. "Okay," I said, "they're all one kind. You really believe it, you're not just giving in." "I believe it. It's not like Lewis Leakey hammering and hammering on Philip Tobias about Homo habilis until he had beat him down. No, I believe it. You should learn to quit when you're ahead." So there's a big precedent here. All right, so the big conclusion of the Cleveland-Berkeley systematic analysis was that the pooled Hadar sample constituted one single species, and that species was to be called Australopithecus afarensis. And this relied on what I call iterative forms of comparative thinking. So comparative reasoning, although its status is sometimes considered to be lesser than experimental data, is one of the pillars of evolutionary biology. The whole origins of species is one big comparative exercise. So comparisons among what? Among ranges of variation in living apes, chimpanzees, and gorillas specifically, and other previously described hominins. And the first conclusion was that, well, the Hadar literally sampled constituted something new, something that has never been described before. But a crucial question was, well, was it one or two new things? And this fundamentally hinged on the possibility of separating the Hadar literally sample into two distinct, morphologically distinct subsets. And a key question to solve this issue was to understand how special was Lucy. Don was convinced that Lucy was something different. There were features that couldn't be accommodated in the variation of the wider sample, what Tim disagreed. We all know that a conclusion of this comparative analysis was that the sample was a single, highly variable, strongly dimorphic species with differences between males and females in size and proportions, with Lucy falling at one extreme of the Hadar range of variation. But I want to suggest here is that between the lines of that discussion, there's another fundamental issue for biology today, which is, well, character individuation. Organisms don't come with predefined, pre-subdivided traits. This is an imposition that we make on organisms to try to understand them. And this problem has been beautifully formulated by Richard Lewontin in an edited collection dedicated to the problem. How are we to recognize the true characters of organisms rather than imposing on them arbitrary divisions that obscure the very processes that we seek to understand? No issue is of greater importance in the study of biology. And this is a problem that I try to address in the context of the evolution of human chin. It's extremely complicated to understand, first of all, what a chin is and whether it constitutes a genuine biological character. But in the context of Lucy, well, the point of focus was the narrowness of the front of Lucy's jaw. So Don was convinced that that demanded specific explanation. But when it was not seen as an isolated trait, but as an integrated part of the jaw design of the Hadar Littoli sample, well, that peculiarity vanished. So it turned out to be an exercise in allometry. So an exercise in, well, scaling and proportions. So the third part relates to the phylogenetic analysis. Well, what was this new single group? Was it Homo? Was it Australopithecus? Was it something else? And attributing specimens to a genus implies a phylogenetic hypothesis. And we know that a conclusion of the comparative analysis was that, well, major differences were absent, so they were not looking at something else. The primitive craniodental features that emerged as a key feature of the pool sampled implied that that was not Homo. This is an idea that initially seduced Don. And there were features that were shared with previously described Australopithecus specimens, but also a set of diagnostic features emerged in the sample that demanded a new species attribution, Australopithecus afarensis, as it was named in 1978 after consultation with Ernst Mayr. There's another interesting aspect that emerges from the scientific reasoning behind species attribution here. It's also the importance of the temporal dimension of variation, and this is possible only when there's a big sample that allows these kinds of analysis. And with the augmented samples over the years, spanning a temporal window of over 500,000 years, it was possible to study a trend in the variation in the mandibles and dentition. This, again, highlights another crucial aspect of taxonomic reasoning, another crucial problem, the inadequacy of using modern ape collections that often in museum sample only 100 or 150 very short time range. And if this is used to estimate ranges of variations in fossil taxa over hundreds of thousands of years, well, this may have a biasing force. So I want to conclude by saying that, well, the naming of Australopithecus afarensis recapitulates core challenges of species delimitation in paleoanthropology that are still there for paleoanthropologists to debate over. And they are here to stay. The importance of delimiting and interpreting morphological variations, the spatial and the temporal patterns, variation due to sexual dimorphism, and the importance to justify trait individuation. The importance of sample sizes to justify inferences and taxonomic attributions, but also fundamentally the importance of understanding the role of available background knowledge and interpretive frameworks in driving taxonomic attributions. What needs to stay and what needs to go when proposing a revision of previous taxonomic attributions. But more importantly, I think that how Lucy got her name and the scientific reasoning that is behind Yusi's discovery highlights how this metaphor is probably one of the most misleading metaphors that is being used to characterize what kind of science is paleoanthropology. It is really a matter of fitting pieces into previously perfectly understood pictures. There's no reference pictures that paleoanthropologists can rely on and don't have all the pieces. And this is, well, arguably the cross and the delight of that kind of specific science that is the science of human origins. So thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.